You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Wow! If you thought yesterday was crazy, another tantrum. As the toddler turns, you hold a meeting. You're going to call a meeting. Last night, made a big deal about it. We're going to have a meeting. We're going to sit down. We're going to negotiate. And then you slam your fist on the table because you don't get your own way. And, well, storm. Did he think? I mean, this is one of those moments where you go, did he really think that the little spiel last night, which was poorly given, didn't really, I don't think, move the needle in any direction one way or the other? I think we're on this issue. The majority overwhelmingly has the floor, of which we don't want a stupid wall. Most people don't want the monument to hate. We want comprehensive immigration reform. We want to fix some of the problems we have. We want to streamline the process a little bit. We want to know who's coming and going. But ultimately, we're not shielding ourselves from the rest of the world. And I keep coming back to this, to that Reagan moment. I guess it's because I remember it so vividly. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall. And I keep thinking, you know, in my mind that's coming for us. If we build this, it's coming for us. And, you know, in watching his little spiel, because I didn't watch it last night. I took a look at it this morning. And the sniffling is, wow, just... whatever he's on, you know, whatever drugs he's doing, maybe slow down just a little bit. Lay off the coke, man. But nothing in that speech moved me. Nothing in that speech got me to go, you know, yeah, okay, you made the case. Nothing whatsoever moved the needle. Look, we know that there's a problem. And there are solutions if the leadership would get out of the way. There are solutions. We can do it. We've done things before. And I know it's hard to believe. I know it's hard to believe. But we've done things before. And this is one of those moments where we better figure out quickly how to start doing things again, because right now we're dysfunctional. Right now our government is broken. Right now... And going forward, things are going to get worse. And our enemies can't be happier. I mean, if you're a hater of this country, you cannot be more thrilled than to see how dysfunctional and how divided. If you're the Russians, for instance, if you're the troll farmers, you have got to be just tingling in the panties over how divided and polarized we are as a nation. over nonsense. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. I mean, this isn't, even Trump himself has said, this wall will do nothing. It's not going to stop anything. Because we know where undocumented people, we know where people come from. This is just one, another one of those moments of kicking the least, kicking the people with the least power. So today, the House Democrats move forward on one of four appropriations bill. It is the latest effort to attempt to end this government shutdown. Today, day number 19, the vote was 240 to 188. You had, I think it was eight Republicans who have voted with the Democrats on this, breaking from Trump, which is pretty substantial because the last time this happened, it was only six. So interesting to see how that's playing out. Obviously, we saw the tantrum that happened today. We saw the big tweet that he said he just left a meeting with Chuck and Nancy. Total waste of time. I asked what's going to happen in what is going to happen in 30 days if I quickly open up things. Are you going to approve border security, which includes a wall or a steel barrier? Nancy said no. I said bye-bye. Nothing else works. I mean, can't you just see a kid in the supermarket, checkout in the aisle, not getting the Captain Crunch cereal or the Lucky Charms, just on the back, just kicking and screaming, I'm gonna hold my breath. Can you just see this guy doing that? I mean, this is the scary thing. This is the president of our United States. And it's one of those things that's just, wow. And if you're Chuck and Nancy, you've got to be going, this guy's way too easy. Can we play poker? I mean, seriously, this guy is way too easy to push buttons and to get to do just dumb stuff. And as, Nancy Pelosi pointed out, look, we just saw a temper tantrum. Couldn't get his way, just walked out of a meeting. And look, this isn't new. This is who Trump has always been. And we've always known that. We're just now seeing it magnified because there's some opposition. Before, there was nobody to tell him no. I mean, this guy is a spoiled child who his entire life has had no one to tell him no. And finally, mommy, who evidently Nancy is now the mommy figure in this, has told him no. And he is throwing a fit. So it's going to be interesting. Evidently tomorrow, I guess Trump will be visiting McAllen, Texas, of which the mayor of McAllen, Texas doesn't want the damn wall. So he's going to go to a place where the people don't even want him there. But he's going anyway, going to visit a portion where he wants his wall. And look, the reality is the majority of us don't want this. The majority of us know this is a waste of money. The weird thing is, someone told me, and I had to look for this. Evidently, there's not one congressional representative that represents the border, all along the entire border, who actually supports the wall. Not one representative. So the people in those districts don't even want it. In fact, what's interesting, a number of Trump voters who figured out that their property would be on the other side of the wall, they're not happy about it. Thrilled when it meant you down there, but when it meant them... No wall. And the thing is, you've got, people who have been the head of Homeland Security in the past who have said this is a waste. It's just, again, this is one of those fixations a child has. I want my way. I'm going to get my way. And I'm going to hold my breath until I get it. And that's the crazy thing in all of this. That is really honestly the crazy thing in this entire situation. Now, while all this temper tantrum is going on, while we're mired in 19 days now and no end in sight, the reality is this is affecting hundreds of thousands of families. This is affecting working people who are being denied a paycheck. These are people who are losing vital government services. These are people who, their families depend not just on the jobs, but also on the services that our government provides. And, again, I go back to, I don't know that I don't believe at all Trump feels our pain. And what's going to have to happen is you know, we're going to have to start. I agree with Trump. Call your elected representative. It's the one thing I agree with him last night on. Call your representative and yell, get our government back open. Because the reality is real families are being harmed in all of this. Real people have real bills they have to pay. And what you have is you have a president who is holding this country hostage. I mean, you know, stop and think about this for a second. They're saying we're going to call all these people back and we're going to force them to work without pay. And I know some people say, well, you know, eventually they'll get paid. Yeah, good luck. We wouldn't stand for this if this was, you know, Walmart, or we wouldn't stand for this if this was, you know, a McDonald's. We wouldn't stand for this if this was any private, Google, any private industry. Would not stand for it at all. In fact, you know, there would be, you know, judicial outrage. How is it that our government can get away with breaking the Fair Labor Standards Act? And the thing that gets me is, look, you know, you've got these people who don't. I know people like to believe that federal employees live high off the hog and they're making, you know, six-figure salaries. They don't. Most federal employees, you know, make $500-$600 a week. They've got reasonable health care. They've got reasonable retirement security. There have been numerous studies done that show that, you know, state and public sector workers make less money in their paycheck than private sector workers. Where they make it up is they get a little bit better benefits. And they have a little bit better job security until, well, now. So the reality is we've got to push these representatives in the direction to say, look, you know what? We got to get things back to moving. What we really need, and this is the part that, again, I keep coming back to while we're talking about the tantrum, while we're talking about Sniffleificus last night, I don't know what that was. While we're talking about the wall, we're not talking about comprehensive immigration reform. We're not talking about a pathway to citizenship. We're not talking about bringing people out of the shadows to undo all of the wage suppression or wage theft, all of the cheating of our government by not paying taxes, by not paying, unemployment, workers' compensation, any of that stuff, Social Security, any of that. And while nothing is being done, the cheating class, of which I would throw Trump in the middle of, they're the ones who are getting ahead in this. And it's time to, you know, lose the focus of this wall and figure out how do we make sure that we have an immigration system that secures our border, has a pathway to citizenship, and brings people out of the shadows. And then maybe let's start having another conversation about how we say, you know what, maybe we start looking around to places where these folks are coming from and try and deal with the problems there so people want to stay or people are able to stay. Just kind of a thought. But that's a much more in-depth conversation. That's a much more difficult conversation. That's a much more difficult negotiation than slamming your fist on the table and saying, I want my wall! Much, much more difficult. It really is. And I understand that. But it's, again, something that, you know, big boys and girls do. It's something that as a country, we're going to have to figure out how to deal with outside of the temper tantrums and the nonsense and the made up crisis and, the fictional, you know, emergencies that don't exist. And, you know, the more I see Trump talk about this and the more I look at what he said in the past, you know, you go, where, what, how? Because nothing he says matches what he said yesterday. My favorite comment of today was evidently they have the people bringing drugs into the country and bringing people across the border have really incredible, tremendous, the best vehicles. They have the best vehicles. They're tremendous. They're incredible vehicles. Much better than our vehicles. Much better than ICE. Much better than the Border Patrol. They got incredible, tremendous vehicles. And I'm going, well, what the hell are you talking about? And that's the thing that gets me. I mean, he throws so much minutiae out there, so much you know what. And the fact checkers, you know, where do you begin? So we got a lot to get to. Just a lot on that. Also, the Democrats are moving forward on some background check stuff. We want to get to that. Lots and lots. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, and talk a little bit, just a touch, about something I agree with that Trump has done with criminal justice reform, and talk about what it means here in Pennsylvania and what we should be doing across the country. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the Trump.
Workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day Robert Goss, president of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, called a nationwide strike against the oil industry. The union sought to negotiate for higher wages and better medical and dental plans in the second year of a two-year contract. 24-hour pickets were set up immediately. For a good portion of the strike, workers at many of the refineries stopped strike-breaking scabs from entering. But some refineries used management and contract workers to maintain production levels effectively. Strikers confronted scabs daily and in a few instances faced violence on the picket lines. At least one manager crossing picket lines was charged with second-degree assault after having rammed his car into a picketer at a Texaco refinery in Washington State. In Texas City, the deaths of two contract workers at an Amoco refinery made news when Amoco refused to allow a union representative to accompany an OSHA inspector through the site. Amoco sought a restraining order against OSHA and accused the agency of interjecting itself into a labor dispute. At Houston's Atlantic Richfield, women mobilized to form picket lines in defiance of an injunction against union pickets. In Los Angeles, area unions including the UAW, UE, ILWU, and the Teamsters formed the Los Angeles Harbor Council in solidarity with the strike. On March 1st, the council conducted a one-day shutdown of the LA ports and strike support rally that demanded victory to the OCAW strike. Oil workers would stay out 14 weeks before the strike was finally settled. They successfully won pay increases and increases in employer contributions to the medical plan and dental plan for the very first time.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Last night we talked a little bit about what happened in Florida, Amendment Number 4, that restores the voting rights of felons who have paid their debt to society. They've done all that they were supposed to do. And the question I have is now, have they turned Florida into a blue state when you've got something, over a million people who were not eligible to vote now, as of yesterday, eligible to vote in the next election. Going to make Florida a very interesting state in 2020. And look, there's actually something the Trump administration has done that I agree with, and it's criminal justice reform. We're finally, I think, coming around to the reality that the prison industrial complex is sucking us dry, all the while, tons of human misery that goes with it, but financially just killing us. I'm here to share some thoughts on, what we could be doing better with that money. I've asked Jamie Martin to come talk with us. She's a professor and chair of criminology and criminal justice at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Jamie, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Thanks so much for having me on tonight.
I'm looking at this, and, there's some pretty good things going on in the world of criminal justice reform, I think, right?
Oh, absolutely. And as you just mentioned, one of the things I was happy to see the Trump administration do is actually be able to usher that through. Of course, I think part of that was Jared Kushner took some lead in that, and I suppose because his father spent some time in prison, he had personal awareness of what it's like. And I'm being serious. I mean, I'm guessing he had some personal awareness of what the misery is and had that background, and I'm sure that's why that was important to him.
No, that's absolutely true. I think of my friend Bob Ney, who spent a little time in jail after his congressional problems, and he is now one of the biggest prison advocates you can imagine because he did spend a couple of years in Moundsville State Penitentiary and saw firsthand what it's like. And, like I said, he's one of those advocates who said, we need to change this.
Oh, yeah. Once you're inside for a while, I think you would become an advocate. And I have to be careful when I say this. I spent a lot of time in prisons and jails, but that's where I do most of my research. And I think if people had some opportunity to go in and see what's going on and see how many, just the vast number of people that are incarcerated in our prisons in Pennsylvania, they might be struck in awe. And I think also a lot of people think they're, you know, country club, med club kinds of places, and they aren't.
Yeah, well, but Jamie, they're supposed to be horrible places, so you don't do bad things.
Right, right, yeah, right.
You've heard
they
that?
They are bad places, yeah. Well, they are bad places. And I think the other tragedy of this is there are so many individuals. Look, there are some people who should never get out.
Yep.
But there are a lot of individuals that I've met, and I'm thinking, why are they here? You know, talking about low-level drug offenders that are spending an inordinate amount of time in prison. And it's just this waste all kinds of capital that we are sitting inside of bars.
And the other part of it is, you know, the reality is the lack of opportunity. Look, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. I mean, there were a lot of really bright people who didn't have opportunity, and they were hustling and doing what they could do just to keep a roof over their head, just to make it to the next day. So when you're talking, throwing desperation into the equation, you know, obviously you're going to have people do dumb things when they're desperate.
Right. Well, and then, you know, the flip side of this, and as you mentioned, the professor, we know the benefits of higher education. You know, so if you have people that are growing up in whatever circumstance and you can see some light at the end of the tunnel and see that you have some hope and maybe, you know, can afford to go to a university and get an education, for some people they can't even think about that at this point because of the costs associated with education.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the personal story myself. You know, it wasn't until I was about 15, and I hate admitting this, but it's true. It wasn't until I was about 15 that I realized college was a place that you went to go to school. I thought it was the only people I ever saw who went on to college were really good athletes, because those are the only people who got to go to college where I grew up. And it wasn't until I was about 15 that I realized, oh, wow, other people other than athletes go to college? Really?
Right. And so, you know, one of the things I did want to talk a little bit about is how much we're spending on. And before I start this, I want to state outright, I'm not being critical of criminal justice. I mean, I worked as a probation officer. I'm not being critical of the Department of Corrections because they're just doing their job.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is we're spending much more just on corrections in the Commonwealth, somewhere between $2 and $2.5 billion, depending on what kinds of cost you might wrap in there, versus, well, total for higher ed is probably maybe $1.5 million.
Wow. So, you know, and how many prisons do we have in the state of Pennsylvania?
I think we're at 24 right now. We've closed a couple, but they're building some additional housing, probably in the neighborhood of 47,000 people. And that's just in prisons. If you start to look at the number of people that are also in jails, now you're going to be throwing that number up into the, you know, 82, 83,000 people.
And how many people go to our system, our 14 universities of higher education?
I think we're at about 98,000 right now.
So, you know, just doing the layman's stupid math, I mean, you know, you're talking about, you know, about $2.5 billion, you said, for corrections, about $1.5 billion for education. It seems like we're spending a lot of money on locking people up.
Right. We've decided to incarcerate rather than educate. I mean, you're talking about legislative priorities here, right? And so if you're thinking about the number of people in prisons, we'll just stick with prisons instead of jails. And if you have a $2 billion budget, that's going to come out to about $40,000 per year per individual in a prison. I work in the state system. Our funding last year was about $468,000, and that's because Governor Wolf has actually been able to restore some of the cuts we saw under the current or the previous administration for 98,000 students.
Right.
So that's about $4,800 a year per student that we're spending. So compare the two. You know, $40,000 for one person in prison. $4,800 for a student at IUP.
We're spending nine times as much to lock somebody up. We could send nine people to college at the same price. We're talking to lock one person. It just seems like, again, screwed up priorities, but not surprising because we're a country of retribution, not you know, not recovery, not rehabilitation. It's about crime and punishment.
Well, obviously, it's become a political issue, right? I mean, you go back to Nixon, you go back to, you know, the first George Bush. We got onto this kick about, you know, get tough on crime you know, if you do the crime, you do the time, and it now it becomes difficult for any politician to back off and say, wait a second, you know, what's this gonna mean for me in my next election? But I think with some of the reform we're seeing now at the federal level and other states, it seems as if we should be having a conversation in our Commonwealth about this. Why aren't we talking about criminal justice reform? We're fourth in the nation in spending on corrections and 48th in spending on higher education.
Wow, that seems like our priorities are really, really screwed up.
Right. And, you know, I've had an interesting experience. A few semesters ago, I taught a class, an intro class in a prison. And when I was teaching those students, you know, they were capable, they were engaged, they were hardworking. Many of them could have, it was like a typical classroom, and many of them probably should have been outside of the prison and on a college campus. But they did extremely well. But then I, you know, juxtaposition that with, I have students on my, in my classroom at IUP teaching the same class, and those kids are capable, engaged, they're also hardworking. But some of them are working a job or two. And I've had students come in to me and say, you know, Dr. Martin, could you put the textbook that you're using in your class on reserve at the library because I can't afford to buy it?
Yeah.
I mean, we just had to open a food pantry, or in the process of doing that at our university. And I know colleagues at other universities, they're doing the same kinds of things because we have students who have food insecurity.
Yeah, well, look, I was just reading a report the other day of the number of homeless college students. And you go,
yeah,
you know, how is that possible? In this day and age, with, you know, as wealthy as this country is, you know, we're the wealthiest country in the nation and the wealthiest country in the history of civilization at its wealthiest point, and yet you've got people who are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to play by the rules, and they're getting beat over the head.
Right. You know, and again, the amount of support they're getting from the Commonwealth is about $4,800 a year. So, you know, they're struggling to be able to afford to go to school and also pay their bills and eat.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this, because, you know, I've got, you know, people about my age who keep going, well, you know, I had to work through college, and I had to take out student loans, and since I had to do it, they should have to do it, too.
Well, yeah, you can say that. I mean, I had to take out a few loans, but when I was at the university, I don't want to say how long ago that was, but suffice to say, and I went to a state system university, I went to IUP, and at that point, the state was paying about probably 74% of the cost, and students are picking up 26%. So, yeah, there may be, you had some student loans, but for, I keep calling them kids, for these young people today, you're talking about they're having to shoulder, and these are state-supported institutions, these are our state universities, they're shouldering 76% of the cost.
So it's completely flipped over from when I was...
flipped over.
I mean, we're talking about massive redistribution of wealth, and, you know, intergenerational, you know, ripoff.
Yeah. And so it's, as I said, it's heartbreaking to sometimes talk with these students when I have these conversations. And at the same time, I've gone into prisons and I'm seeing a lot of people that shouldn't be there.
Yeah, but you know, don't you think... You know, here again, you know, I know I'm going to get email on this of people going, well, you know, my kid can't go to college and my kid's, you know, taking on all this debt. Why are you talking about, you know, criminals? Why are you talking about criminals getting to go to school? And, you know, we've created this kind of hunger game situation, you know, in education and not just in higher ed, but, you know, K through 12 as well. When you look at, you know, how these charter schools are stealing funds from the public schools, you know, we've created this kind of hunger game scenario. You know, of scarce resources, and then say, hey, I want mine, and then, you know what with the other guy over there.
Well, that's exactly what it's like. And even when I talk with some of my students in class, they'll see similar kinds of things. My question back to them is, if we put a person in prison, and most are not going to be there forever, maybe, you know, 2 to 3 years, and when they come out, what is it we want them to be able to do? I mean, most people say we want them to be productive members of society. Well, what tools do they need to be able to be productive? And you're typically now back to education.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Other than the prison industrial complex, who says we want them to come back.
Right. Well, exactly. There obviously is that part of it as well, because we have people that will serve their time, get out, go to school, and then all of a sudden find they have to check a box. Have you ever been arrested of a crime? Have you ever been convicted of a crime? You know, those kinds of things. So that all of those doors were shut to them as well.
Yeah. Which, again, another one of those issues that I say we absolutely have to address. I'm a big fan of Ban the Box. If you've done your time, if you've paid your debt to society, at a certain amount of time, you should be able to move on from it. It shouldn't be one of those things that hangs around your neck forever.
No. And for too many people, that's also the case. But, you know, there are times when I've heard legislators talk about we don't have enough money to be able to give more money to higher education.
Right.
They act as if the criminal justice part is a fixed cost. And I remember talking with one legislator who said, you know, we don't have any choice but to, this is the budget for corrections. I was like, well, with all due respect, you actually do have a choice. You can change some laws. You can make some different, you know, different decisions about what are the legislative priorities.
Yeah, as a country, as a commonwealth, we can have different priorities. And you're right. You know, I've had conversations with people who say the same thing. You know, that you know we have all these criminals, we have to lock them up. But I'm going, you know, we have more people locked up right now than at any point in our country's history, and most of it is, you know, ridiculous drug law stuff.
Well, and people say that. I mean, we are seeing the incarceration rate go down a little bit, but the bizarre part is the violent crime rate, and actually just the crime rate in general, is probably at its lowest point now since maybe the early 1970s. So we saw it peak in about 1996, and so you see the crime rate going down, but the incarceration rate has continued upward for quite a while. Within the last couple of years, seeing a little bit of a downward turn.
Yeah, because I think legislators have figured out, look, this is costly. I mean, even Tom Corbett, as much as I didn't like him as governor, you know, even he was saying, look, we got to empty out some of these prisons because it's costing us too much money. I mean, at some point, even Republicans, fiscally conservative people, have to go, this is a giant waste of money.
It is. And, you know, I've talked with my students in classes and always say that prisons are like the field of dreams. You know, if you build it, they will come. Because once you build them, it's hard to shutter them up.
Yeah, and once you build them, you know, you sign contracts with private corporations to have, 90-95% occupancy. So you're paying for the heads and beds anyway, even if they don't have people in them.
Right, and I mean, I just looked, and I think overall the 24 institutions are probably at about a 95% occupancy or capacity, but some are actually over. You know, maybe 104, 105%. And that leads to all kinds of other problems in the correctional institution. But, right. So, I mean, it's a complex problem. But I think once you get the, what are our priorities, answer that question, and you can figure out what do we need to do to make some reforms. And the amount of money that could be saved or actually transferred from what they call fixed cost or a fixed budget line item in criminal justice, why wouldn't we be shifting that to education when we know what the benefits of education are at all levels?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. So then let me ask you a last line of questioning. You know, how do we get to that place? You know, how do we move from, you know, this is how we've always done it, Jamie. This is how it has to be done to there's got to be a better way to allocate resources to make lives better as opposed to, well, creating, you know, career criminals. Because look, if you've been locked up for any bit of time, your resume is shot. You're not going to get, you know, a really decent job. To me, how do you go to hope and opportunity as opposed to despair?
Well, I think first you have to have some courageous legislators who are willing to take on looking at some of these things. I mean, criminal justice reform would include getting rid of the need to check the box. You're going to have people that are hopefully more compassionate and can see that, you know, individuals can make mistakes and actually, you know, pay their price for making that mistake and then go on. I think we've lost civility in our country, and that's clear from watching, oh, I won't go there, and we've lost compassion. So I don't know exactly how you get back to that point, but I think it's going to take some courage on some folks, and we haven't always been it this way.
No, look, at the minimum, you know, just radical self-interest, you know, the fact that, you know, that, as you pointed out, when the state system of higher education was started here, you know, the state picked up about, well, I think it was like, you know, three quarters of the cost. The students picked up about a quarter. Now it's completely flipped on its head the other way.
Right.
You know, returning to where we used to be, where my generation and folks a little bit older were able to benefit. Maybe we want that for our kids. Even if that's the way you got to make the argument, it's about radical self-interest, other than helping others. Maybe that's the way you got to go, too.
Yeah, that could be. You might have hit the nail on the head with that.
We live in crazy times. But, Jamie, I appreciate the time, the thoughts, the information. It's shocking. I mean, it's the amount of money that we waste on this. Just absolutely shocking. But I appreciate the time and look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Rick. Have a good evening.
Thanks so much, Jamie Martin, professor there at IUP in Indiana, University of Pennsylvania. And look, I mean, the money we waste on this is just, like I said, staggering. And I'm not saying we don't lock people up who do horrible things. But, you know, there are alternative sentences for low-level drug offenders, for, you know, people who do stupid things when they're younger. It just seems like we could do better. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Own 90% of the wealth. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people. Own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1939. That was the day a new radio show began on CBS Radio.
Welcome to the motion picture star's own radio program, The Gulf Screen Guild Show. With Jack Benny, Joan Crawford,
the show featured some of the biggest names in Hollywood. All of the actors' fees were donated to the Motion Picture Relief Fund. The fund was started in 1922 with the motto of taking care of our own. Proceeds from the show went to support the motion picture Country Home for Retired Workers in the film industry. These included actors, cameramen, set designers, and even security guards. These retired workers only paid what they could afford to live there. Eventually, the retirement home allowed working people from the television industry as well. Gulf Oil sponsored the program for its first three seasons. It was called the Gulf Screen Guild Show. Over the years, the show took on several other sponsors and names. It also migrated to NBC, then to ABC, and then back to CBS Radio. In all, it ran for 14 seasons and more than 500 episodes. In its early years, the show was a variety review. It included songs along with dramatic and comedy sketches. Later, the show recreated films for the radio audience. It was a challenge to get a whole film down to just 22 minutes. Films covered by the show included classics such as Casablanca, Arsenic and Old Lace, and Pinocchio. But despite the changes and challenges, the show raised $800,000 for the retirement home by 1942. The retirement home was almost closed in 2009, but continues operations. Workers in many industries have long found creative and collaborative ways to support each other and to truly take care of their own. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The mistakes of the bosses we must pay for. From the cities to the farmlands and trenches full of mud. Cause war has always been the boss's way, sir.
Smith Show. Check out the website, ricksmithshow.com. So Illinois Congresswoman Robin Kelly is reported, you know, pointing out that she's the head of the House Oversight and Government Reforms IT Subcommittee. And I know that's real hard to get to, but, you know, there's someone who oversees our IT. There's someone who, when there's a problem, there's a subcommittee to go to get, you know, things fixed. That's how our government kind of works. She's saying, look, the longer this shutdown happens, the more you have these shutdowns, the harder it's going to get for us to get good qualified people. And this is part of, you know, these shutdowns, I've always said, play into the hands of Republicans because they despise government to begin with. So if you can starve government of talent, if you can starve us of the best people to do our bureaucratic jobs, to make sure that, you know what? Someone's making sure that the back doors are closed so that Russian hackers don't get into our FBI or into our IRS or into our voting rights, or, you know, hack into anything, or even just boring stuff. Maybe you want somebody who's, you know, making sure that our computer system's somewhat secure. Just kind of a thought. Just want to throw that out there. But one of the things that struck me is in the report, they point out that, you know, the brain people, the people in IT, in the Treasury Department, the people who are 60 and older outnumber the people who are 30 and younger 10 to 1. And in Veterans Affairs, the people who are over 60 outnumber the people who are under 30 19 to 1. We're not attracting the younger people, because look, who wants to go through this? Who wants to go through these shutdowns and being used as a political pawn? And she's saying, look, you know, you know, how can you recruit? How can you maintain people? How can you get young, hardworking people to come to government when you're telling them, sorry, you're not going to get paid? And you go, well, eventually they'll get paid. Well, interestingly enough, story broke today. And we talked about this a little bit last night with Phil Glover from AFGE, who reminded me back in 2013 when they shut the government down then, when Republicans forced the shutdown then, people had to show up to work and didn't get paid. And here we are, 5 years later, they still haven't been paid. So a lawsuit's been going forward for them to get payments for the hours that they worked. Problem is, now that the government shut down, the Justice Department attorneys and many of the other employees who were working on processing these payments that the court has said have to be made, well, they're unemployed. So, I mean, this is the Republican dream. This is conservatism's dream. You've hobbled government, and now you go in for the kill. Oh, here's the best part of this. I forgot to mention the best part of the court's ruling, because the court said that, you know, as part of the Fair Labor Standard Act, that you can't have, you know, at the time, 2013, it was 1.2 million workers who were forced to come to work and not paid. You had to pay them at least the minimum wage. So these 1.2 million workers who worked, you know, from October 1st to October 5th, you know, 8 hours a day, sometimes 10, they're going to be paid minimum wage, not their actual wages. So not only do you have to come to work, you're now a minimum wage employee. Do you think the people who are working today, who were working then, don't remember this? And then you wonder why you're hearing reports coming out that people in the TSA are leaving, that a lot of people are, you know, screw this, I'm going to go find a job somewhere else. Again, though, this is exactly what our friends in the Republican Party want to happen. Because I had someone email me, say, well, what we should do is we should just privatize the whole damn thing. When it was brought up that the IRS might not be sending out refund checks, then it began, we should privatize it all. Again, something we heard during the Bush years about privatizing the IRS. Just another one of those moments where you go, the game plan then becomes kind of apparent for some Republicans. I don't think Trump's this bright, but I do think there are some in the party who go, hey, opportunity. Create crisis. Don't let crisis go to waste. Opportunity to do all of the nasty stuff they've always wanted to do. Seriously, I mean, that's the amazing part in this. And to me, again, the fact that these people worked those days and got minimum wage for it. And if that case tells us anything, these people who have been off for now 19 days with no end in sight, don't you think they're looking at this story too and going, what? I'm working for minimum wage? Scary, scary, scary stuff. Now, those are just federal employees. Don't care about them, evidently. At least the Trump and the Republicans don't seem to really care about them. You would think they would care about the people who were overwhelmingly their supporters, farmers, you know, who have just been, you know, really just beaten up. The tariffs, which, again, I support the idea of using tariffs as a trade enforcement tool. But understand, the farmers have taken it on the chin. And if you're a country that we do trade with, you got to know whenever the farmers squeal, politicians act. Well, what's going on right now is the tariffs have harmed them. So what we did is we passed a piece of legislation, say, about $12 billion we're going to hand out in farm welfare. So we're going to give out checks for about $12 billion. Problem, the checks haven't come yet. Checks not in the mail. And as this one story goes, this farmer in Southern Virginia doesn't have any seeds, doesn't have any money. He's been decimated by the tariffs, was hoping that the welfare check would come in so that he could buy seeds. So what he then did, he said, okay, well, the check hasn't come. Going to go to the Department of Agriculture. Going to see if there are any essential personnel there still working to kind of help. Because he was kind of hoping maybe there'd be somebody left, you know, janitor could point him in the right direction, something. No. And, you know, as we continue down this path, we're going to keep hearing stories like this. And, you know, if this continues, even the Trump supporters, even the people who are the most ardent supporters, the people who are putting big signs out on their farm saying, you know, I'm a producer and we got to do something with these parasites while taking welfare checks. Even they are being harmed by this. And maybe this is going to be what it takes. Maybe it's going to take the agricultural community to squeal a little bit before this administration does something. Because understand, it's the agricultural community who benefits most from our current immigration system. Do you think they want a wall? Do you really think, you know, the big agribusinesses, do you think the farmers want to shut off their supply of labor? I mean, seriously. It's just, it's quite remarkable. And we're just in this weird world where, you know, up and down don't seem to be up and down anymore. Very, very strange. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
From UN headquarters in New York, I'm Luke Vargas with your World in 2 Minutes. Campaigners calling for a second Brexit referendum made their case in a new report on Wednesday, arguing that with lawmakers deadlocked on a Brexit deal just months ahead of Britain's EU departure, voters should get another chance to make their preferences known. Matthew Goodwin is a professor of politics at the University of Kent.
If you look at the House of Commons, there doesn't appear to be a majority currently for any particular outcome.
That goes for Prime Minister Theresa May's current Brexit deal, the prospect of a no-deal Brexit, a softer Brexit deal known as the Norway option, or for calling a second referendum. That could change if Brexit Day nears and nervous lawmakers think another public vote could bail them out. Executed poorly, though, that vote could actually make things worse. Akash Pound is a senior fellow at the Institute for Government, a London think tank.
If you just had a straightforward repetition of the 2016 referendum question, if the result was another vote in favor of leave, it still wouldn't necessarily resolve the current political deadlock that we face because there is no agreement on what Brexit should look like.
There are some creative alternatives, like a two-question referendum, in which voters chose again whether to leave the EU and, if so, how to do it, or a vote that rated different Brexit options in order of preference. But Goodwin worries even those options ignore the reality of Brexit, that it's not just the politicians who are divided, but the public too.
We're not seeing that outbreak of mass regret that many predicted.
And were Brexit to be defeated by the narrowest of margins in a second vote, possibly on lower turnout, the crisis in confidence in the British government could make the current Brexit mess look tidy by comparison.
I think any attempt to go back to the country, have a second referendum, possibly overturn the vote to leave the European Union would create a political and constitutional crisis in British politics.
Luke Vargas, The United Nations.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. We often think of labor history as an urban movement happening on the shop floor. Yet farm workers have played an important and often overlooked role in labor history. Such was the case today. The year was 1939. More than 1,500 Missouri farmers and their families began a highway sit-in. The action was organized by the Southern Tenant Farmers Union, one of the few unions in the 1930s that accepted both white and black members. The Southern Tenant Farmers Union had been formed in response to New Deal policies. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Agricultural Adjustment Administration was meant to aid the nation's farmers, who had been economically devastated due to the Great Depression. Yet little of this federal assistance found its way to the tenant farmers. Landowners kept most of the money for themselves. Displaced tenant farm families piled all of their possessions along the side of the highway in protest. These farm workers, their families, and all of their worldly possessions lined two major highways in the Missouri Delta. The tenant farmers braved frigid temperatures day after day. As a tactic, organizers published the actions with photos and newsreels. The newsreels showed startling images of the impoverished farmers and their meager possessions huddled in the freezing cold. Embarrassed by the images, Missouri state authorities moved on the demonstrators and forced them off the highway and into areas the protesters called concentration camps. The actions did catch the attention of President Roosevelt, who directed the Farm Securities Administration to provide assistance, including funding for housing for some of the displaced workers. As John Hancock's Great Depression-era tenant farmer, union advocate, singer, songwriter wrote, "Homeless, homeless we are, just as homeless can be. We don't get nothing for our labor, so homeless, homeless we are." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
So I came across some tweets of Dr. Scott Gottlieb. Dr. Scott is the commissioner for the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And not real good stuff. He wrote in a thread, the food safety during the shutdown. We're taking steps to expand the scope of food safety surveillance inspections we're doing during the shutdown to make sure we continue inspecting high-risk food facilities. 31% of our inventory of domestic inspections are considered high risk. He goes on to say, we're still doing all of our regular foreign food inspections, but on the domestic side, in rough numbers, we typically do about 160 domestic food inspections a week. And about a third of those would be considered high at risk. We assess risk based on an overall cross-cutting risk profile. The primary factors contributing to the facility's risk profile include the type of food. I would guess romaine lettuce would be one of those. The manufacturing process and the compliance history. So we're only going after the worst actors right now. So everyone else, deep sigh of relief. We're not coming for you. He goes on to write, commodities deemed high risk include but aren't limited to modified atmosphere packaged products, acidified and low acid canned foods, seafood, custard filled bakery products, dairy products including soft, semi-soft, soft ripened cheese and cheese products, unpasteurized juices, sprouts, ready to eat, fresh fruits and vegetables and processed fruits and vegetables, spices, shell eggs, sandwiches, prepared salads, infant formula, and medical food. He says the agency they oversee about 80% of the food supply. Evidently, we've cut that down to, I guess he said a third, right? So, I mean, for those of us who don't like eating salad, win. So this is winning. Congratulations. I can now tell my wife that I can't have salad now because the food inspections aren't happening. But you know, this is the kind of crazy stuff that happens in this environment. And when you've got the guy who, I didn't even know who the commissioner of the FDA is. The fact that I now know who Scott Gottlieb is a sign that something is dysfunctional in our government. These are another one of those agencies that, you know, they exist, you know, they're doing their job, but we don't know who they are. They just do their job. Now we've actually got to be thinking about, you know, could this lettuce kill me? You know, could this apple, could this, you know, congratulations, Don. This is what you've accomplished. Mission accomplished. You're causing crisis. And it's probably not even the one you were hoping for. Anyway, some good news coming out of Iowa. A federal judge today struck down an Iowa law. You may remember back in 2011, there was a ton of video activity on social media about how these companies were treating chickens and how they were treating cattle and the puppy mill stuff. You know, people would get jobs in these factories, and then they would take undercover video and they would come back and they would show you how things are being processed. And the idea was, you know, to raise awareness and also to get people going, holy crud, this stuff's happening in our country. So Iowa, the lawmakers there quickly said, oh, we can't do that because, you know, we're a slaughter state. And quickly passed a law that said it was illegal for you to get a job in a place, you know, like a chicken factory or a cow slaughterhouse or a pig, whatever, and to do so, to take video and to do, you know, undercover investigation stuff. No undercover operations. In fact, they made it, you know, to where you could serve a year in jail if you did it. So obviously the ACLU, which, I love and hate at times, the ACLU moved forward and said, look, this is an attack on free speech. You can't do this. Well, a federal judge today struck the Iowa law down, saying, look, you know, maybe if there was a chance that somebody would find out, maybe you wouldn't do it. And that was my argument back then. I'm going, you know, if there's nobody watching, how much worse do these conditions get? How much more do they do? And if you remember some of these videos, I mean, it was horrible. I mean, really, look, obviously you're killing these animals, but you can do it in a way where you're there was the one video of the people throwing chickens against a wall. And it was just, you know, and the conditions under which, you know, they exist, and the puppy mills are the worst, which again is why when we got a dog, we weren't going to the mall pet shop to buy a puppy. We went and we found one. Although it was quite an endeavor, we did go to a shelter and say, hey, you know, we want a dog. Now, granted, we went in March, didn't get it till August. But, hey, you know, we went through the process. And I guess you could make the argument, well, you know, they want to make sure they're going to a good home. I think you can do that in a shorter period of time. Just kind of throwing that out there. The idea was we wanted to get the dog for our son's birthday, which was in April, and again, it didn't come till August. But I guess, look, the month started in A, so it got it somewhere near there. And his name starts with A, so maybe it just all kind of worked itself out. But you know, I look at this stuff, and you can't even make that up, that a state would pass a law like that, and the fact that our court has to strike that down is just incredible to me. But at least something remains functional for now. I assume that somewhere down the line, things could get crazy. Now, as I understand, and I didn't mention this earlier, there are a couple of lawsuits being filed against the shutdown. AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, they filed one. Tomorrow we're going to, I think Friday, we're going to talk to the head of the Treasury Department, the Treasury Workers Union, about their lawsuit. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And all the while, people are still being forced to work without pay. And again, this is another one of those moments where, and I'm going to pimp the union a little bit, they're out there fighting. They're out there doing what they can. They're out there, you know, holding rallies. They're out there raising awareness. They're out there getting their members to contact Congress and getting their members to get active, even the ones that aren't affected by this. And this is another one of those moments where every union member in this country, every worker in this country has to look at this and say, look, if we allow this to happen to those workers, when does it happen to us? When does it come back and bite us? That's the scary part. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, our good friend Kerry Pennerbaker is going to be here, share some thoughts on last night's, whatever that sniffleificus thing was, and also talk a little bit about the Democrats pushing for background checks. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the top.